uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. Maybe if I turned up your monitor gain, Paul, that would help. Yeah. Anyhow, welcome back to our program. Stumbling through the world of cyberspace here. Trying to get computers to work and everything else. Tom Hartman with you. Our telephone number, 1-866-889-8894, if you'd like to call in. Our website, TomHartman.com, if you want to drop into our live chat room. And greetings to all the folks there. Usha says greetings, Tom, and all the other folks in the chat room. Hello, good morning, good afternoon, whatever it may be, wherever you are here now in the radio home of democracy in Pittsburgh. Big news for our listeners in Pittsburgh on WPTT. A conservative mole who's a Pittsburgh anchorman taught Jeff Gannon. This is very interesting here. This in the Daily News, the Philadelphia Daily News blog, covering Philly and the world like Cheese Whiz, is Attitudes, A-T-T-Y-T-O-O-D's blog, and this from that particular blog. And it says the bloviations of Arianna Huffington's new blog, the Huffington Post, and he's talking about, it's a big deal, but maybe it's not a big deal, except that somebody posted something there that would be TV newsman Scott Baker, that maybe he will think, don't believe I should have said that, as time goes on. Scott Baker, for nearly a decade, has been the anchor man on the 5 p.m. and noon newscasts on Channel 4 in Pittsburgh, WTAE, a Hearst Argyle station that carries ABC programming, and Attitude blogs. But Baker has another job, one he doesn't list on his resume, although he does sort of fess up to in his Huffington Post post. It turns out he teaches journalism to young conservatives at the Leadership Institute School of Broadcast Journalism, founded by Karl Rove associate and former National Young Republican director Morton Blackwell. And Anchorman Baker is not just their star instructor, he's also a graduate. But here's where it gets really interesting. Here's what he wrote on Arianna Huffington's blog, apparently. He says, "I'm the guy who taught Jeff Gannon everything he knows about journalism." I'm not sure I would have said that. I mean, even if it's true, I'm just not sure I would have said that. I would not want to be the guy who taught Jeff Gannon anything. But, you know, on the right-wing side of the dial, apparently this is a badge of honor, that you can teach a gay hooker how to pretend to be a news reporter. Anyone who's studied this, back to the blogger, anyone who's studied the Leadership Institute knows that the school, with a hefty $8 million annual budget, has one mission and one mission only: to teach dyed-in-the-wool right-wingers how to get involved, or some would say infiltrate, the mainstream media. Blackwell, the GOP activist for whom the Pittsburgh anchor was a lecturer, was a Virginia delegate last summer at the Republican convention in New York and caused a stir by handing out purple Band-Aids that said it was just a self-inflicted scratch, but you see, I got a purple heart for it. Yeah, this is the essence of true journalism. So does it matter, asks Attitude, the blogger in Philadelphia, does it matter if the anchorman for a Pittsburgh TV station is an enthusiastic conservative? Well, it might. If he also injected himself and his ideology into the heat of a presidential campaign, and, says the blogger, there are signs that in 2004 Scott Baker may have done that. Remember the Boston brouhaha, Attitude says, when Teresa Hines Carey told another conservative journalist, Colin McNichol, of the Richard Mellon Scaife-owned Tribune Review, to shove it? Guess who the reporter was who reported the story, and whose cameraman pictured the encounter between the two? You guessed it! Scott Baker. This is what a Pittsburgh-area blogger had to say of Baker's coverage. Quote, "It's possible that Scott Baker had a camera operator keep rolling when he saw McNichol start to question Hines Carey or arrange for the columnist to be there." You know, this person basically wondering if, if Baker was, you know, essentially set this thing up. So back to Attitude's blog. Attitude says, so let's think about this. One of the top-rated stations in the number two city in a battleground state, a state that many thought that summer would decide the presidential election, sends as its reporter to cover Kerry at the DNC, a man who also trains conservative journalists at a school run by one of Karl Rove's best friends. And then when he gets there, he doesn't cover what the Democrats have to say, but he does go big with a confrontation that was potentially embarrassing to the wife of the party's presidential candidate. And then asks the question rhetorically, do Baker's bosses at WTAE know what their anchor's strange moonlighting work may be? Good question. We'll keep an eye on it and see how this plays out as time goes on. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Alan in Trumansburg, New York on the line. Hey, Alan, thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I'm great, but I'll get better. What's up, Alan?
I'm kind of worried about a battle that it seems we've just lost in the war for control of the media when Karl Rove's buddy was put in charge of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Yeah, not just his buddy, as a childhood friend of his.
I mean,
a lifelong friend of his.
Well, I wondered if I could get you to talk about that, and what's the big picture on that war? Is there hope for us? I know you've told us that all of the TV networks are owned by major corporations, and I think I've heard that like 90% of
roughly
talk 90... radio is right wing.
Yeah, and it goes beyond that. Roughly 90% of all media that is read in the United States is in the hands of about 15 corporations. There's about 12 corporations that control the majority of over 15,000 different magazines and newspapers, and then you have five corporations, basically, or arguably three, if GE owns MSNBC as well as NBC, three, four, five, depending on how you count it, corporations that control most of what people watch on TV. You make it six or seven if you want to expand to the local things, you know, Clear Channel and Sinclair, that and radio as well. So yeah, this is what Vladimir Putin was pointing out to Mike Wallace in his interview with Mike Wallace, whenever that interview happened, you know, a few weeks ago or a few days ago, whenever it happened. And what was interesting is that oligarchic control of the media in the United States that Vladimir Putin pointed out to Mike Wallace, while it's in the transcript that you can read at CBSNews.com, it didn't make the 60 Minutes program. But that's not the PBS. That's what you called about originally, right? PBS.
Yeah. Well, it seemed like when Air America was formed a year ago, that was a cause for hope. And now this with the CPB, and it kind of gets smacked back down. I just wanted your feel for the big picture. Are we gaining on them? Are we going to... is there hope?
Well, all of the above, Alan, in my opinion. First of all, you have to understand with regard to PBS that this is a 10-year war at least. I mean, it's been at least a decade, arguably much longer. You could track this all the way back to Ronald Reagan's coming into power, the conservative attack on the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. First of all, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting has not been around all that long. It was created by LBJ in, as I recall, 1964 or 65. So, you know, it's a relatively recent thing. And the idea was, let's have a national media like BBC and Deutsche Welle in Germany and countries all over the world. You know, they have a national media that is supposed to be able to put out unbiased news. And in order to make sure that it was unbiased, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, which owns essentially the NPR and the content that goes into them, they have control over budget for NPR and whatnot, but there's a two-year lag. So they, you know, the ideal is that it's not possible for them to make instant changes. But now what we have is with Kenneth Tomlinson, the former the Republican chairman of the agency, Karl Rove's old friend, is now in charge of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. He stacked the board of directors. Six out of the nine board of directors are Republican hacks, many of them with no experience in broadcasting whatsoever, and, you know, openly partisan. They recently hired a former White House official who was still working for the White House when she first started to set up an ombudsman's office that is to evaluate the fair and balanced nature of PBS. And this is very much a war on public broadcasting because they perceive public broadcasting as the last bastion of liberalism. The whole point, I think what really brought this to a head, Alan, was when the study was done And I forget who did the study. It might have been Pew, but one of the big survey groups did a study about a year ago and found that it was before the election anyway, and found that those people who watch Fox News, something like 70-80% of them believe that there were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, that Saddam Hussein was responsible for 9/11, that Iraqis were flying the aircraft, you know, this kind of nonsense. And whereas only about 20-some-odd percent, a little more than 20, a little less than 30% of people who watch public television or listen to NPR believed that nonsense. And so, obviously, the Republicans said, hey, wait a minute, the enemy is NPR. So they've been mounting this challenge for some time, and now it's really coming to a head. And the problem is that a lot of people are saying that they're not going to support their NPR stations anymore. And, you know, because it's turning right wing. They're not criticizing corporations. They're not criticizing the government. They're walking on eggshells. And that's going to cause, if NPR then perceives that there's a loss of liberal support, then they're going to start throwing out, you know, I mean, they already got Tucker Carlson on the air. They're going to start throwing out more conservatives to try and get conservative support. And there's no shortage of conservatives with a lot of money who will support it. So it's a catch-22.
Well, you don't sound too optimistic about the way it's moving.
I'm not. I'm frankly very concerned about it. And I think the only thing that's going to change it is people getting concerned. 35,000 people now have called or written to the Corporation for Public Broadcasting to protest this. But the Bush administration says, so what?
Can you talk a little bit about the Fairness Doctrine? Is that a potential solution?
No, it's not. The Fairness Doctrine was repealed in 1987 by Ronald Reagan. And it was 86 the Fairness Doctrine was repealed. And the Fairness Doctrine really had nothing to do with public broadcasting. What it said was, if you're using the commercial airwaves and, you know, you're going to use them, but it's the property of we the people, then if you present political view A and political B view B contrast with it, you have to also be sure to present political view B. And the death of the Fairness Doctrine under Reagan was followed within 6 or 8 months by the appearance of Rush Limbaugh. No surprise there.
Well, why is that not a solution? If we put the Fairness Doctrine back in place, the percentage of left-wing ideas would grow exponentially, wouldn't it?
Perhaps. I think what would happen, I was in broadcasting when the Fairness Doctrine was law. I was working, in fact, I did news for 7 years in Lansing, Michigan at a radio station there. And my experience of being on the air during the Fairness Doctrine was that we just didn't get into politics. I mean, you just didn't do it. We did a two-hour show. I was on WITL, and we did a two-hour afternoon talk show. I didn't do it. Chuck Drake, the guy who was the owner of the station, did the show. And, you know, he would talk about what's going on in the community and who's going to have his garage sale and that kind of stuff. But we just didn't get into politics because nobody wanted to deal with the Fairness Doctrine. So, you know, I'm fairly ambivalent about the Fairness Doctrine. And plus, I can tell you, in this Congress, it's not going to come back. This is going to require citizen action if people want to save public broadcasting. It's going to require a lot of it, and it's going to require it very fast, and it's going to require the people on air at PBS to speak out. And I don't think they're willing to. I think they're terrified. Alan, thanks for the call. We'll continue on this topic as time goes on. 20 minutes past the hour.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
You may be an ambassador to England or France. You may like to gamble. You might like to dance.
Hey, you're going to serve we the people?
You may be a champion of the world. You may be a socialite with a long string of pearls. But you're going to have to serve some.
Now, I realize this song actually had a different context when it first started. It was part of Bob Dylan's conversion experience, which he has since backed away from, I believe. But nonetheless, I think it's apropos. You know, are we going to serve we the people? What is the purpose of an economy? What is the purpose of a government? Is it simply to exercise power? Is it simply to accumulate wealth? Or is it to have a culture, a society, a world in which it's a reasonable and decent place to raise your kids and to live? That's one of the fundamental splits between the conservative worldview and the progressive worldview. The liberal or progressive worldview says the purpose of an economy and the purpose of a government is so that we the people can administer the commons, so that we the people can take care of ourselves, so that we can make sure that we're well-educated, we're well-informed, we're healthy, we're happy. Happiness, by the way, a word that first appeared in the founding document of a nation for the first time in the history of the world in the preamble to the United States Constitution, 1789. It was ratified. 1787 it was written. The first time in the history of the world the word happiness appeared in a document. And so does government play a role in the happiness of people? Should it? The founders certainly thought so. Jay in Atlanta is on the line. Hey, Jay, welcome to the Tom Hartman program.
Hey, you know, the last few days, like last night, I was listening to Mike Malloy, and before that, the Young Turks, and they're both harping about that memo that came out last week, you know, about the fact that they basically manufactured the evidence.
The MI6 memo that Bush had decided in the summer of 2002 to go to war against Iraq, and he was basically saying, he told the Dear Love, the head of MI6, that we're going to fix the intelligence to follow the policy. Yeah,
right. And you would think, you know, someone like yourself, as well as informed as you are, we all know just dozens of other stories that just rise to the occasion of impeachment.
Yeah.
And this one, you would think would be the straw that broke the camel's back, where we'd say, okay, enough already. But my 2 points are, one, there would be, and then on Mike Malloy's show last night, after he harped on it, a guy who called up took it to the next level of the whole 9/11 conspiracy. And the bigger point I'm making is, you can't just say, okay, impeach Bush and Cheney and everyone in his administration, because there's no mechanism that says who would replace him if it's the whole damn administration. That's my first point.
Well, let me just address that.
Yeah.
There, you're absolutely right in that if you impeached Bush, you end up with Cheney as president, which may be even worse, and then you may end up with Tom DeLay as vice president, or Denny Hastert, or, you know, God only knows who they would appoint. And it could be worse. But if you look back at what happened with the Nixon impeachment, that, you know, ultimately, we almost got Spiro Agnew, right, which could have been a real disaster for the country. But the bottom line is that it so showed the corruption of the Republican Party, and so showed the corruption of what was going on among the conservative movement at that time, that it led to the election of Jimmy Carter. I mean, it led to a reaction. So I'm not opposed to an impeachment. And articles of impeachment against George W. Bush have been drawn up. They were drawn up by Ramsey Clark, the former Attorney General of the United States, and they've been introduced into the House of Representatives. But, you know, the Republicans, of course, are never going to let them out of committee. They're not even going to allow there to be an investigation.
But so what kind of legitimacy would a government have if, so Bush gets impeached and then we replace him with Cheney and the rest or whatever, and everyone's going, okay, these guys are in charge, but we know they're corrupt to the heart. So
what would happen, Jay, is that if that were to happen in this year, then in 2006, when about a third of the Senate and all of the House of Representatives are up for re-election, you would see a Democratic landslide, and we would take back the House and the Senate, and that would be the end of their power.
All right, I hope so. But last night I spoke to Michael Reagan on his talk show, and I said, what's your reaction to this memo regarding Blair and such? He didn't even know what the hell I was talking about.
I know
how telling that is. But the good news is, his argument, when I summed it up for him, was that George Tenet told him it was a slam dunk. I said, well, then shouldn't George Tenet be fired? And he actually said, absolutely, George Tenet should have been fired.
Yeah, but, and that's the thing. I mean, a few folks are waking up here and there, but I'm not sure that anything that comes out of Michael Reagan's mouth could be described as waking up. But nonetheless, it's the American people are getting it, that we have been lied to by this administration, and that it's not a good thing for democracy. 29 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
You tell him, Jackson Brown. And welcome back, my friends. 27 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-889-8894. Our telephone number, TomHartman.com. If you want to drop into our live chat, just please do not send me private email or private messages while you're doing it, because I just have to shut them and can't even take the time to read them because it covers up my call screening software. Anyhow, back with you, 27 minutes before the hour, 1-866-889-8894. Our telephone number, Jeremy in State College, Pennsylvania, on the line. Hey, Jeremy.
Hi, Tom. Getting back to this whole media topic, something that's very important to me as an employee of a PBS affiliate. My other concern is the Republicans and the conservatives would so defund it that it would dissolve and cease to exist, and I would be out of a job.
Well, in fact, I'm looking at an article in the Los Angeles Times, Jeremy, and it says that PBS is facing a 25% cut in federal funding next year.
Yeah, and it's getting harder on our membership drives, too, as I see it happen on the ground level. But to segue into something else that's related...
Let me just ask you, what, from the inside, I mean, you work at a PBS station, mm-hmm. what do you think is the solution?
To be honest with you, I really don't know, because I'm more in the technical end, not in the programming end or the fundraising end. I'm more involved in vector scopes and waveform monitors and that kind of stuff.
Right, but you hear the buzz around the station, don't you?
Yeah, I do. And I think that, I definitely have seen a leaning towards allowing the right-wing opinion to be dominant, especially when that Postcards from Buster show came out with the lesbian couple.
In Vermont,
our station did not air it. However, we do have a half public affairs program we air every Tuesday.
Uh-huh.
And we expanded on it for an hour about a month ago, and we aired the show in its entirety and then took viewer feedback. And to be honest with you, the response was half and half. There were some people who were very, air this, it's an abomination. I made my children avert their eyes when that 30-second segment was on, when they're cheek-to-cheek in the picture. And other people called and said, it's good that you're diversifying ideas, you know. It really flew both ways.
Yeah.
So I think, to be honest with you, the solution is, in a broader context, is we really need to reframe the argument of what media is all about. And that's where I was going to go back to the fairness doctrine. I'm pursuing a graduate degree, mm-hmm. and I actually wrote a thesis paper on for this semester on the fairness doctrine.
Oh, interesting.
And technically it's still a policy. They just choose not to enforce it.
Oh really? I thought it got pulled right off the ledger.
Dennis
in 86.
Patrick was the FCC chairman in August of 87 when they did the Syracuse Peace Council decision, which was the Meredith Court versus the FCC, when they said they were just no longer going to enforce it.
Uh-huh. So it was 87, not 86.
Yeah, it was August of 87.
Okay,
it's still
thank
on the
you.
Books. They have just chose not to enforce it. And Clinton's FCC was a very business-friendly SEC, as you know, in terms of media and broadcasting.
Well, in fact, Tomlinson, this guy who is leading the takeover of Corporation for Public Broadcasting, was actually appointed by Bill Clinton.
Right. Yeah, Clinton was very, very bad for media policy in this country, in my opinion.
Sure. But, he signed the Telecommunications Act of 96.
Exactly.
Which was horrible.
Right. Right. But the bigger point is the whole argument of the media has been framed as this marketplace of ideas. It's a marketplace, a marketplace, a marketplace. That totally undercuts the idea of social responsibility.
Right.
And I think the framing of the argument has to change, because like even Mark Fowler, the FCC chairman, who was instrumental in getting rid of the doctrine, although he wasn't seated when it actually got axed, he compared television to a toaster with pictures. And that was where it was, you know, media, marketplace, marketplace, marketplace. No, they still hold to some semblance of social responsibility.
Right.
And then they say, well, you know, now we're in that scarcity argument. Well, the original reason for it was because broadcasting was a scarce resource licensed on behalf of the people. They have to serve a public trust. Now with all the extra media outlets we have and everything else, that scarcity argument no longer applies. That's just not true. In a technical sense, it doesn't, but in an ideological sense, it does. And I think we need to start framing arguments better. I mean,
let me just toss this out, Jeremy, and you tell me if this is consistent with the frame that you're suggesting. Instead of saying that broadcasting and the job of the FCC and whatnot is to, on the one hand, simply allocate frequencies and
right.
make sure that there's not interference between stations, or on the other hand, to be an arbiter of community standards and values and mores, but instead, on the third hand, as it were, that broadcasting is like a conversation in a community, and the you know, it's like a town hall meeting sort of thing, and that the purpose of the FCC is to facilitate a conversation that involves and includes as many people in the community as possible, not as few as possible.
Absolutely.
Is that a reasonable way to put it? I'm trying to come up with a one sentence description that, you know, or a frame or a concept that people can get. Oh, broadcasting
right.
is about community. And see, that will also make sense to the folks who are saying, hey, the FCC should play a role in making sure that their children are not exposed to something that they don't think that they should be. Because I do personally think that there are limits. I don't want my children seeing explicit violence on television, for example.
Right. There has to be some rational fairness to it. And that's where, you know, I agree with you. The fairness doctrine did have its share of problems, but it also was very effective. And that's why Norman Lee formed People for the American Way.
Right.
He combated jury follow on the old-time gospel hour, because that's really where the beginning of, like you were talking about yesterday, with the whole religious idea, where religion is now starting to play a bigger role in politics.
Yeah.
That all started to formulate very, very well in the late 70s, early 80s, around people like follow on the old-time gospel hour. And their opposing of the fairness doctrine was one of the big linchpins to get that whole movement started.
Jerry Falwell, you mean?
Yes.
Jerry Falwell's opposition to the fairness doctrine. And
correct.
And that, you know, may have been a harbinger of the desire of the folks in the religious right to get into politics, which they've been doing so successfully. Jeremy, I've got to move along. Thank you for the call.
No problem.
And thanks for the point that you made, and I hope you call in again. It's good to hear from you. 1-866-889-8894, a telephone number. Marshall in Richmond, Virginia on the line. Hey, Marshall.
Hey, how's it going?
I am great. What's up?
I got a question for you.
Yes,
I'm a large music fan, and specifically Dave Matthews Band.
You mean you're a fan of large music, or you're large and you like music?
Hey, it's a little of both.
Okay.
But what I was calling for was last year when they were doing that Vote for Change tour.
Yeah.
Do you think that may have, you know, singled those people out? I mean, do you think that was a bad move? I mean, I was kind of worried. I was very proud to see them going out against the evil side, but at the same time, kind of thought, hey, if this doesn't work, these guys have just stuck their necks out. And I heard about the Nokia guy the other day that didn't get to go on some trip because he gave $250 to John Kerry's campaign.
Right, the Bush administration. And this was a trade delegation to Central America to discuss frequency allocations for cell phones. It was a bunch of techies. It was a geek conference. And this guy was forbidden from going, or at least forbidden from going at government expense, because he had given $250 to the Kerry campaign. It's, you know, welcome to the wonderful world of Joe Stalin. That's basically where we're at these days. And that's why it's no surprise to me that George W. and Vlad the Impaler over there in Russia, the former head of the KGB, are buddy-buddy.
Yeah.
I mean, there's not three inches of daylight between the two of them, you know? It's
except for when they're apart and they're talking trash about one another.
Well, and they both understand that they have to do that for domestic consumption, that Vlad has to talk to the Russian people about, oh, there's all these problems with American, and Bush has to talk to the American people about, well, you know, the Russians aren't all that, you know, and they both do it with a wink and a nod, because if Bush was really committed to democracy, he would not have free speech zones where anybody who tries to show up where he's speaking is taken out and put into a barbed wire cage.
Yeah, seriously. But just one quick shameless plug for anybody that cares.
Sure.
New Dave Matthews album came out today.
Aha!
There's several references to George W. Bush in the form of pig, devil. I mean, it's
good grief.
Great.
Yeah. Okay.
But,
the new Dave.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. It's it's like, do they know? I mean, can they take on these people? I mean, is it wise to go against people that restrict rights, that, you know, break the law on a regular basis?
Time will tell. Time will tell, Marshall. I don't think that we know. There was the Dixie Chicks, the blowback, but I think that thing against the Dixie Chicks was more a reflection of cultural, of national hysteria than, you know, a specific attempt at censorship. I think that there really was a sense in the United States that, hey, we need to pull together right now. And you know, for right or wrong, I'm not defending it, but I think it was real. In fact, at that time, it was just after that, that I joined the IE America Radio Network. And they had been on a lot of radio stations around the country. And one of their hosts, or a couple of their hosts, started blasting Bush right after 9/11, and it just didn't fly. I mean, a lot of radio stations canceled the programming, and it wasn't because, you know, they were saying, hey, we're not, you know, going to go along with, we want to dance to the tune of Bush, or Bush said that we should cancel this program. It's because the listeners were saying, hey, let's just pause the anger and the rhetoric for a moment. We need a national month of healing and mourning or something like that. Now, unfortunately, the Bush administration came in and exploited that. And used it shamelessly. But the reality is that I'm not so much a fan of the conspiracy theory on the big sense. For example, here's why. Bring this back to media and the discussion about NPR. The largest distributor of progressive talk programming in the United States right now, the corporation that is delivering more progressive talk programming to anybody in the United States right now than any other corporation, is Clear Channel.
Okay.
I mean, you know, so go figure. This show is on two Clear Channel stations. I do a morning show on a Clear Channel station, and without Clear Channel, there would be no Air America. Clear Channel is what, you know, is distributing, I don't know the exact percentage, but I would guess it's probably 90% of the total listenership that's being delivered to Air America is on Clear Channel stations in the major markets. And the bottom line for Clear Channel, they want to make some money.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, the CEO is an old friend of Bush's, and he gives money to Bush, but the bottom line for the corporation is, hey, let's make some money. And so I think ultimately, however all this shakes out, the good news is that you can use the beast against the beast, as it were, that if there's money, you know, the old joke about, you know, a capitalist is a person who would sell you the rope to hang him with. On the other hand, the downside is the danger, the cautionary tale that I think we forget at our own peril, of what happened at MSNBC with Phil Donahue. Phil Donahue was on MSNBC. He was the number one rated show, the top rated show on that network. He was making more money for General Electric than any other show on MSNBC, bigger than Chris Matthews, bigger than Joe Scarborough, bigger than any of them, Phil Donahue. Number one show, and GE decides to dump him because they don't like his politics. And that's where it gets dangerous. And I think that there should have been substantial blowback to GE on that. And this gets back to the point that I think it was Jason who made earlier about, you know, at what point does government get into this? Marshall, thanks for the call. Good to hear from you. I appreciate it. And you know, I hope folks go out and get the album and you know, onward it goes. But this the whole thing of the Leaning Tower of PBS, as the Los Angeles Times calls it, is a really interesting one. And you know, those of us in the media are stuck with this very odd conundrum, of that, you know, Randy Rhodes, for example, who I absolutely admire. I think Randy Rhodes is the top talent in progressive talk radio in America right now, in my opinion. And, you know, she was working for Clear Channel in Florida for years and years. And, you know, so it's like, how do you say, oh, you can't do, it's like, I don't think that the rules are clear. How do you figure this stuff out? I don't know. You know, how is it going to shake out? I don't know. But, you know, what I do know is that as long as we have an opportunity to be speaking truth to power, as long as we have an opportunity to speak up and say our minds, as long as there is a demand for it, and there clearly is, because, you know, major corporations are getting involved and they're and saying, hey, we can make some money on this, and that it will grow, and progressive talk radio will grow, and progressive voices will be heard. Now, the question with regard to public broadcasting is the extent to which people can make their voices heard to say, hey, we want to take this thing back. I don't know. We'll see. I am very, very concerned. You get the former editor-in-chief of Reader's Digest, a very, very conservative publication, who is heading up PBS. They're talking about a 25% cut in federal funding next year. He's put in an ombudsman, Tomlinson, this guy, who was appointed, let's remember, by Clinton to the PBS board. He's put in an ombudsman to make sure that the programming on PBS is fair and balanced. You know, what's the solution? As I said, I just don't know. I think that the, you know, one interim solution is to do everything we can to encourage local broadcasting. And I realize that that's a very strange thing for a national talk show host to be saying, but, you know, I think that, you know, local broadcasting is really important, and it should be encouraged. And whether that's something where we all get together and change the rules and say, hey, there has to be a certain percentage of local content in all programming if you want to have a broadcast license, whether it should be something like that, or whether the tax laws should be written in such a way that radio stations, for example, TV stations that produce local programming can do so and get a tax break for doing it. I mean, there are ways that you could actually use this to enhance the profit of businesses that are in the media and serve the public good. And we historically did that. I mean, the whole Nixon-Kennedy debates were on TV because the government was involved in the TV marketplace and said, hey, if you want to have a license, you have to participate in this in some way. So it's a complicated issue, a complex issue, and yet at another level is fairly straightforward. And here you got Tomlinson coming out saying he's not out to kill PBS broadcasting and programming, and John Lawson, chief executive officer of the Association of Public Television Stations, says he hasn't observed any attempts to do so, and yet at the same time there's this this chill, this freeze factor that's going on through, you know, it's just scaring people on PBS stations all across the country. Like the fellow who called in and said, hey, you know, he works for a PBS station and he can see it coming. He can feel it coming. And I can tell you, the folks that I know in public broadcasting are concerned that they're seeing their fundraising drop. They're seeing that they're not getting the kind of money that they used to get. And people I talked to, I had this discussion over breakfast with Paul Loeb, the author, here in Portland a couple of days on Sunday. And Paul was like, you know, I know people that are not going to be supporting public broadcasting anymore because it's turned to the right. Ever since 96, for example, in 1996, PBS outed Archer's Daniel Midland for, you know, this criminal behavior, essentially. ADM now sponsors PBS. PBS doesn't talk about ADM anymore. You know, could there be a link between the two? Some people think so. Others don't. It's a tough one. 10 minutes before the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Close your eyes, close the door.
Oh, it's Bob Dylan Day.
You don't have to worry anymore.
And welcome back, my friends.
I'll be your baby tonight.
Oh, it's incredible. For a guy who can't sing, he sure can sing. Five minutes before the hour, coming up on 4 minutes before the hour, I believe. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Spike in Easton, Pennsylvania on the line. Hey, Spike.
Hey, how's it going, Tom?
Great.
I'm a regular caller here, and I've called before. And I asked you once about, you know, how do you get involved in bringing more progressive views and things like that, maybe to the local community, and you said, you know, pay your dues. And I've actually now enrolled in a TV radio program at the local community college.
Hey, good on you.
So that I can get more involved. And that's really the biggest thing that more people, you know, if more progressives want to hear more progressive views out there, they got to get involved and get in there.
Yeah, and that doesn't necessarily mean getting on the air. It can also mean volunteering for a community radio station. It can also mean just calling a commercial radio station and saying, hey, I really like the programming that you're carrying. It can mean calling the sponsors of a program that you like and say, I'm going to buy your products or I'm going to recommend your products even if I don't use them to other people because you sponsor this kind of programming. Those kinds of commercial activism are actually very powerful.
Definitely. I mean, and that's the whole reason I even bought satellite radio, for that matter, is for liberal talk. Because,
mm-hmm.
you know, I live near the Philadelphia media market where there's a million conservative talk stations and there's no liberal points of view, even though there's a ton of liberals in this area.
Yeah, it's really strange. We're on the air in Pittsburgh, but not in Philly.
And Pittsburgh's generally more Republican than
Yeah, I know.
The Philadelphia
it's
area.
It's ironic, and the show's doing really great on WPTT there. Anyway,
well,
as you were saying.
Oh, no, that's perfectly great. And I was also glad to hear you mention, once again, Phil Donahue, certainly somebody I wish we could hear more of.
Yeah, lest we forget. I mean, that is a story that really needs to be repeated over and over, you know, what has happened.
Not to mention, of all time, he was not only the creator of talk television, he was one of the best.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, even long before this whole Iraq fiasco, he always brought relevant, intelligent talk conversations into this matter.
Yeah, he was Oprah before there was Oprah. Because everybody, you know, she's the star du jour for talk television. Anyhow, Spike, thanks for the call. Good to hear from you, and congratulations on the good work, and keep it up. I'm really, really pleased that you're out there doing that, and that one of these days I'll be tuning into you on the radio. Tom Hartman here with you. We'll be back with more of your calls after the top of the hour. Tom Hartman Radio Program, 1-866-889-8894. The place where smart people get their news. Truth and common sense in broadcasting for a change.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, 7 minutes past the hour. 1-866-889-8894, our toll-free telephone number nationwide, outside the United States, 1-503-248-0620. And RB in Saskatoon, Canada on the line. Hey, RB.
How are you, Tom?
I'm great. What's up?
Hey, I wanted to talk about Bush's trip to the Netherlands.
Well, you really are in Canada, aren't you? A boot.
Yes.
Okay. I always know when it's oot and a boot, it's Canadian.
You don't even realize we're doing it, you know.
I know, but it's I can spot it a mile away. I love it. It's a beautiful accent.
So Bush was in the Netherlands, and apparently he had an impromptu Q&A with some students lined up, right?
Yeah.
This was not pre-scripted, and he wasn't given the questions in advance. And after the first couple of questions, he asked the reporters that were traveling along to please leave the room, and they did.
You're kidding.
He had his entourage. And then I guess some of the but it was a glass room, so everybody could see what was going on in there and his discomfort and his humming and hawing. And I guess some of the people out in there, and one of them was, Mr. President, why, if the United States is the richest country in the world, why do you have 60 million uninsured people?
Right.
Health insurance. And his response was, well, in America, we value small business.
Oh,
there was a logical...
There are tears in my eyes as I'm laughing here, RB. It's,
and I guess another girl was asked him, how come if America is always talking about being the leaders in, you know, freedom and justice and human rights, why are you always involved in so many wars?
Yeah.
He had no answer, apparently, for that one.
Yeah. Maybe. So this is the thing. I mean, you look at Tony Blair being questioned in prime minister's questions, or even during the campaign, people coming up and saying, hey, you lied to us. We're not going to put up with this anymore. He comes into his own campaign events, and half the people in the room are booing.
Yep.
And that's a democracy. Here in the United States, George Bush goes into a meeting, and everybody is on their feet cheering because you have to be a Republican to get in. I'm telling you, George W. Bush is not a small-D Democrat. That is, he does not believe in democracy. He's a Stalinist. He believes in single-party rule, just like Vladimir Putin does.
Well, him and Putin are both oligarchists, I like to call them.
Well, I think Putin is actually afraid of the oligarchs.
Well, he's taking over them.
Yeah,
well, he's becoming one.
There you go.
Yeah. It's all power struggle in Russia. And another thing about this, did you hear that the CIA, that CIA Gary Schoen interview with Mr. Russert, where he talked?
Hey, RB, I think we've lost you.
No, are you there?
Yeah, I'm still here.
Okay. Oh, sorry, there's a little glitch on the line.
Well, you mentioned CIA, and it's an international phone call, so they just had to, you know, all of a sudden now it's you, me, and Alberto Gonzalez.
No, there was a CIA interview with that Gary Schoen on Tim Russert, and he actually talked about one of the directives he got was to go into Afghanistan beforehand, assassinate Bin Laden and leaders, I guess. Well, this is the story, right? Remember,
right.
Once CIA, always CIA. Remember that. And the point. And Bush asked was one of his requests was for Bin Laden's head in a box in dry ice.
Yeah, or on a pole.
And the rest of the leaders on pikes. And I'm thinking that's just stuff they're putting out to appease the right wingers and to make everybody think that he actually did care about going after Bin Laden because. Later on in the interview, he says, oh, and by the way, Pakistani ISI knows where Bin Laden is.
Of course they do.
But we can't go in there and get him because if we did, then Musharraf would be assassinated and then
the
Islamists would have a nuclear bomb.
That's right. And Musharraf is hanging on by a thread. He's absolutely hanging on by a thread, and that's why we have been unwilling to go in there and stir that particular pot up. I mean, what's amazing is that this guy in the war on terror in favor of democracy against dictators, we have Pervez Musharraf, who is a dictator. he overthrew an elected democracy.
In fact, it was under the Clinton administration when I remember Powell being on TV after the coup when they got rid of Benazir Bhutto, her successor.
Yeah.
And by the way, if we're fighting terrorism, why weren't we on Benazir Bhutto's side? She was against terrorism, tried to fight it tooth and nail.
Right.
And we undermined her because she was a woman who believed in democracy.
Well, the problem was she was a secularist on the one hand, so she upset the Muslims in her country. And on the other hand, she was in favor of democracy. And, in fact, she was in favor of the kind of democracy, a liberal democracy, like you see in Western Europe, for example, where the government actually plays a role in making sure that we the people have, you know, enough food, that there's health care, things like that. Things that are called by the cons socialism.
But the thing was, if her movement had been supported by the West a lot more, I mean, who knows? I mean, that was a woman in a Muslim society who had a lot of popular support.
Oh, yeah.
And the next thing you know, she's under house arrest, and we're not going after the militarists who put her there. We're making cozy deals with them. Yeah. And I don't.
Well, keep
know.
In mind, this was when we were also sucking up to Saddam Hussein.
Exactly.
and you know, providing him with weapons. So,
yeah.
RB, thanks for the call. Good points you made all. I do appreciate it. And thanks for listening to us there in Saskatoon, Canada. 1-866-889-8894. Doug in Santa Fe, New Mexico on the line. Hey, Doug.
Hey, Tom. One of my local news broadcasts, I had heard that Cheney won his appeal not to release the information that from the energy meetings.
I thought that my recollection was that the Supreme Court ruled on this last fall before the elections, and the way that they ruled was that he does have to release that information, but only after an appropriate interval. That he didn't have to release it immediately, that he could, you know, and everybody interpreted that to mean that he didn't have to release it until after the election. And now it's probably going to be he doesn't have to release that until after the elections of 2006.
Well, what I heard.
Maybe I missed it.
On CBS News, it was radio news,
mm-hmm.
that the appeals board ruled in his favor, that he no longer has to, that the, who's the two groups that are bringing the case up?
It's a Judicial Watch and one of the environmental groups. I think it might be, it's either Earth Watch or Greenpeace, or it's one of them. I frankly don't remember which one. Yeah.
The news report said that they could not prove their case, that it was necessary for the American people to find this, and ruled in the favor of the corporate interests and Dick Cheney, so he no longer has to release it. I was just wondering maybe...
I'll have to look for that story.
I have access to a computer right now, so...
Yeah, I'll have to look for that story. I didn't know that, Doug, and it's possible it just happened this morning, and it's something that flew under our radar. But I will certainly keep an eye out for it, and I'll report more thoroughly on it tomorrow.
Sounds good.
Or perhaps somebody in the chat room can track it down and give us a hyperlink, and during the break I can read up on it and report on it today. Doug, thanks a lot for the call. Great to hear from you. I do appreciate it. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Mary in Michigan on the line. Hey, Mary.
Hi, Tom. Oh, I'm so glad I finally get a chance to say hello. I'm a long-time listener, but a first-time caller.
Well, thank you for calling me.
Thank you. And first of all, I just want to say how very, very much I appreciate you. It just seems so great to have at least one voice that will tell us the truth and be honest with us. But what I'm calling for is... I'm just wondering what your opinion is. If you think that with the 2006 elections coming up, if... things like this will make a difference here. And I live in Grand Rapids, Michigan here. And, Tom, since February, we've had 11 bank robberies, and a couple of them which people were hungry.
Mm-hmm.
We had one instance where a young man, and the cops came and bought their family some food, so it wasn't a lie. He robbed a bank to feed his family. We've been devastated by manufacturing losses here, as you probably know.
Yes.
Michigan is the highest unemployment, leads the nation in highest unemployment rate. And I'm just wondering, and you talk to people, so many people are suffering right now. I've got a lot of friends who, through catastrophic illnesses, had to lose their jobs. I've got a friend right now that has terminal cancer, and of course can't work, but and now because of the bankruptcy changes, they're fighting really hard to try to file bankruptcy before that law takes effect. Anyway, with all of these different problems, I wonder if you think this kind of thing will have effect on people that voted for Bush in the past but are being devastated by his policies in the present, right?
Yes,
now.
I think so. I really do. And in fact, I think that if Bush had not, he was very slick, if Bush had not taken 9/11 and turned it into a Pearl Harbor type of event as opposed to an Oklahoma City type of event, then the Republicans wouldn't have captured the Senate in 2002, and if he hadn't then invaded Afghanistan and Iraq, he wouldn't have to the extent that he did win, and I'm still of the opinion that he didn't win. I think that the exit polls were right and the voting machines were wrong, but I may be a nut on that, and I'm perfectly willing to admit it. But to the extent that he got any votes at all, he wouldn't. I don't think that he would have gotten the votes that he got if people were simply looking at his record. If people just you know, really were looking at what was going on instead of this fear mongering. He had Tom Ridge out there every day going, "Oh, the alerts are now yellow. Now they're red. Now they're orange. Now they're look out, it's orange again." And you know, we haven't heard a word about that since the election, have we?
Nothing.
Not one word. Nothing. And so it's pretty clear to me that the only way that these guys can win an election is by diverting our attention away from their true agenda, which is economic. Their real agenda is about money and power, and divert it instead to secondary agendas that are sufficiently hot and distracting, like sex and sexuality, like gay marriage, and war, and terrorizing people. And so, therefore, I think in 2006... my guess is, you know, we know now that back before, just before the 2002 election, Karl Rove went down to Texas, Bob Woodward lays this out in his book, and sat down with George W. Bush and had this little PowerPoint presentation about his 2004 election campaign, and that the war in Iraq was all part of that. You know, you're going to be standing tall, Mr. President, you know, no war president has ever failed to get reelected in the history of America, blah-de-blah-de-blah, and that it wouldn't surprise me if they're having meetings right now, or if they had meetings even, you know, 6 months ago, about what war are we going to have for 2006. We've got to have another boogeyman. There's got to be somebody else to scare the American people. And they've been ginning this thing up with North Korea and with Iran. I think it's no coincidence that North Korea and Iran both of their nuclear programs were absolutely stopped and stabilized all through the Clinton administration. And Bush comes into power, and all of a sudden the genie's out of the bottle. Why? Because it's useful to us, or it's useful to Bush, rather. It's harmful to us, to we the people. So I'm guessing and hoping that the war that they're going to create for the 2006 election will be with Syria. Although Syria has been doing everything it can to avoid that. They pulled their troops out of Lebanon. They've been providing intelligence to the U.S. Military and to our intelligence agencies. They're allowing us to have wars on their border and not saying a word about it. I mean, they're doing everything they can to be, you know, good citizens in the neighborhood. Because I think that they think the same thing I do, which is that Bush has a history of attacking countries that can't fight back.
Yes.
And this is why, of course, the Iranians and the North Koreans are trying to build nukes as fast as they can to prevent Bush from attacking them, because they know, like a classic bully, he only attacks countries that can't fight back. Just like Reagan, you know, let's attack Grenada. It'll make him look tall. And so... But the good news, Mary, is I'm convinced that there's no way, not only Bush, but I mean, you look at Rick Santorum's numbers in Pennsylvania. He's 13 points below a Democratic challenger who hasn't even won a primary yet.
Wow, that's good news.
Yeah, and it's like all across America, people are waking up and they're saying, hey, wait a minute, the Republican agenda is an agenda that is devastating to the middle class. It's economic insanity, trade insanity. It only benefits the multinational corporations and inherited wealth. They're all about corporate power and inherited wealth and nothing else. And people are starting to wake up to it. So I think that that's the good news. The bad news is they already know that. They've fooled us in the last two elections over the last 4 years. And, you know, will they be successful in fooling us again? We all have to be very vigilant. We all have to be, you know, telling our friends, telling our neighbors, pass the word along. Tag, you're it, Mary. pass it along.
Thank you very much, Tom.
Okay, thanks a lot for the call. Great to hear from you. Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye now. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. 20 minutes past the hour.
I guess I better let the dog in.
Like the small dog that rules the house, Small Dog Electronics is the small computer company that really rules when it comes to customer service. Small Dog Electronics is your...
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
I'd like to take you to the ceremony. That is if I remember the way.
And welcome back, my friends. Leonard Cohen, 25 minutes past the hour. It's hard not to keep listening, but it is talk radio, not music radio. Anyhow, welcome back. I do have the Dick Cheney story, and in fact, the caller was right. I'll share that with you after we talk with Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service. And thanks, by the way, to the folks in the chat room who got it for us. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, how are you?
I'm great. I just discovered that Dick Cheney doesn't have to turn over his Energy Task Force documents. Is that a buzz in Washington, or has that not yet hit the news in a big way?
It suddenly will become a buzz. Tell us more. You're ahead of the game.
Oh, okay. Well, this here, this was just published by the Associated Press. I mean, apparently just very, very recently, like, you know, an hour or so ago, a lawsuit seeking to force Vice President Dick Cheney to reveal details about the Energy Policy Task Force he headed and the pro-industry recommendations it made was scuttled Tuesday by a federal appeals court. Basically, their rationale, Victoria, was that because the guys from the industry, because Ken Lay didn't actually get to vote on the committee, that therefore he wasn't like an official member, and therefore the vice president doesn't have to tell us what was said or who was in the meeting. So he finally won. I mean, basically the Supreme Court had kicked this thing back down to the appeals court back last year, and I thought that the ruling was that he had to reveal it, but he could wait. It turns out that I was wrong by kicking it back down to the appeals court. Of course, that got him the delay. I was right about that part, but it didn't mean that he had to reveal it. It meant that the appeals court was going to rule, and they ruled 8-0 unanimously that he didn't have to release this information.
Well, I guess they can go to the Supreme Court. I don't see how they're going to get anywhere with them, though.
Yeah. So now it's up to the Sierra Club and Judicial Watch to see what they're going to do. Yeah, I can't imagine the Supreme Court taking this on, especially after they've already bumped it down to the district court once.
Yeah.
So that's the news of the day from Washington, D.C.
Oh, well, that's depressed a lot of people around town.
Yeah. So what's happening on your beat there, Victoria Jones?
Well, here, everyone's talking about the nuclear option. That's sort of the buzz in the corridors. You can hear people quietly talking about, you know, is it going to happen? When's it going to happen? How's it going to go down?
Right.
Because at this point, they are feeling, and we talked about this yesterday, at this point, they are looking to think that it is going to come to a head sometime this week. Now, whether it does or not, whether the whole thing's a bluff, don't know, but that's how it's looking right now.
Yeah. Oh, my. Well, we'll see. I think I might have said to you on the air yesterday, and I'm mixing up sometimes my morning show and afternoon show. I'm not sure when we had this conversation, but
it was this time of day.
Yeah. Okay. Well, as I said yesterday, I'm convinced that these guys win no matter what. If there's no nuclear option, then they get to say, "Oh, the Democrats obstructed us. The Democrats are terrible. Don't vote for Democrats." And there's an election coming up. And if they do the nuclear option, then they get to stack the courts even worse than they already are.
It is really quite, quite fascinating.
Yeah.
Part of the buzz in Washington is President Bush's very successful trip to Georgia. That is one thing that people are talking about. Also, his, you know, going off schedule by, I think it was 72 minutes, which is completely unheard of for him, going out to dinner unannounced, you know, with the first family in Russia, in Georgia. All this is stuff that he just, generally speaking, doesn't do. People are very interested with why all that suddenly happened, and no answers, of course. Meantime, as I'm sure you've already heard, more came out about John Bolton, the U.S. ambassador potential to the U.N., who comes up for his vote in the Senate Foreign Relations Committee on Thursday, now that the number two in the State Department, Richard Armitage, had problems with him as well.
Yes, and in fact worked aggressively to keep him out of the loop in a few things.
Yes. I mean, that, you know, in any business, it's serious stuff when you work hard to keep a senior executive out of the loop. It's very, very, very serious stuff in government.
It's a bad sign.
Very bad sign. But at this point, it looks as though that vote will go ahead. Of course, I'm quite sure that Senator Biden and others, in light of this and other things, are going to try and delay the vote again. Well, I just don't know whether there's the wherewithal among the Republicans, and the feeling is that there isn't to hold it up.
Yeah, very interesting. Okay, by the way, Victoria, would you please be sure to ask Ellen to email me right away? I'm coming to that conference on June 1st, and the engineers here need the information to do the remote. So for Radio Row, and I haven't gotten a response from her. So, anyhow,
I will do so.
And we'll see you on June 1st.
Okay.
Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, thanks so much. 29 minutes past the hour at the Tom Hartman Program.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. did in fact the conservative from Georgia who runs the website that outs abortion doctors say on the Alan Colmes show that he had had sex with animals and that every farm boy does. I don't know. I think so. I'm believing the website that had first laid it out, newshounds.us, and hoping it's not a spoof. I have the story here. It's a fascinating story, assuming that it's true. Maybe somebody in our chat room can ferret this out. I would think that Alan Colmes would be, you know, touting this screaming headline here. It, maybe not. I don't know. Anyhow, Tom DeLay's salute, a wave goodbye. Could it be a wave goodbye? Well, Mark Leibovich in the Washington Post makes a good point. He says, if things weren't bad enough for Representative Tom DeLay, now his friends are planning a tribute in his honor. A tribute in his honor? Mark says, not to be cynical about this, but oh, what the heck. You know you're in trouble in Washington when this happens. It's Thursday, May 12th, that they're going to be doing this. If form holds, the salute to DeLay, which is scheduled for May 12th at the Capitol Hilton, will feature a series of speeches testifying to his greatness and scores of hushed table conversations about whether the Texas Republican will survive as House Majority Leader and, more important, who might succeed him if he doesn't. So this is going to be the topic of conversation, no doubt. Tom DeLay has been a stalwart champion of conservative principles in the Congress. Reads an invitation to the salute, which is sponsored by the American Conservative Union Foundation. Tickets cost $250 or $2,000 per table or $10,000 to be a member of the host committee. Now, that would be interesting. That would be really interesting to buy a ticket to sit at the table and then show up with an anti-DeLay T-shirt or a sign or a poster. What if Code Pink? You know, what if the women who get out there and make outrageous statements, well, they're not outrageous, actually, make truthful statements, and they get hauled off. That's what's outrageous. Get hauled off by the security details or the Secret Service or whatever. What if Code Pink was to buy a table or somebody was to buy it for them and they showed up at this Tom DeLay, hoop-de-doop? I think it's about time that people started saying, okay, we'll play this game. We'll get in on this thing. I think that would be really interesting. It would be an interesting outcome there. The invitation, of course, makes no mention of DeLay's mounting ethics problems, writes the Washington Post. His problems with his fundraising, his overseas travel, his ties to lobbyists, the indictment of three political aides in Texas on charges of illegally raising money from corporations. It doesn't mention any of that. Newt Gingrich in 97, you'll recall, just before he fell, was the subject of a salute to Newt luncheon in 1997 when Tom DeLay was criticizing him, by the way. Here's an irony for you. It was Tom DeLay who basically overthrew Newt Gingrich. Remember that? The National Journal, by the way, speaking of Tom DeLay, now reports that in 1998, Tom DeLay helped kill a congressional fact-finding trip that was being planned as part of an investigation of sweatshop conditions in the garment industry of the Commonwealth of the Northern Mariana Islands. Peter Hoekstra, the Republican from Michigan, was leading a fact-finding investigation into worker abuse in the island's garment industry when DeLay's office threatened the lawmaker with loss of his subcommittee chairmanship if he continued the investigation. See, I'll bet Peter Hoekstra thought that he was safe being a Republican congressman from Michigan, and that the other Republicans would go along with him. Sorry, Republicans eat their own. I mean, this is DeLay's office threatened him with the loss of his subcommittee chairmanship. A former aide to Peter Hoekstra of Michigan recalls, "We were under very strict orders not to deal with the Marianas." Hoekstra made it very clear that he was to lay off. He was told to lay off the Marianas. Another former aide charged Hoekstra returned to his office one day in mid-1998. After a meeting in the Majority Whip's office, the congressman was upset, complaining to his staff, "They shut us down." They, of course, being Tom DeLay. And why? Well, because the sweatshops on those islands were clients of Jack Abramoff's, the lobbyist who has Tom DeLay in his pocket. Surprise, surprise. We're having a bit of a problem in the United States right now with labor and immigration. And this is a topic that, you know, we haven't talked much about on this program, and I just wanted to raise this. I just want to lay this out in a way and see if it makes sense to you. Here's my take on this. People are complaining about, and Lou Dobbs, of course, with his program on CNN, is leading the charge on this. And, in fact, it has led him to endorse the Real ID Act, which I think is a horrible mistake, creating a national identity card. You know, your papers, please, sir, complete with an RFID chip. So if you walk within 30 or 50 feet or 100 feet of a police car, they know immediately who you are. If you show up at a protest, they know immediately who you are. They don't even have to ask you. They can simply interrogate the chip on your driver's license from afar. And this, by the way, is going to, almost no doubt, pass this afternoon. If you object to it, you can call your member of the United States Senate, 1-877-SOB-USOB. We'll get you to the United States Senate. And you can call your senator and say no to the Real ID Act, please. But in any case, the thing that has pushed this hysteria about immigration, or illegal immigration specifically. And there is a reality there, and Lou Dobbs is correct when he points out that roughly 10% of the population of Mexico is living in the United States right now and working in the United States, and usually at wages below the market. And people say, well, you know, they're working for $6, $7, $8 an hour. Sometimes it's under the tables. Very often there's no benefits paid. The cons are trying to put a, you know, lipstick on this pig. They're trying to say, oh, you know, but they're paying into Social Security and they'll never get the money back, so they're helping support our Social Security program. Well, true, to the tune of $7 or $8 billion, it's not that much. It's just a drop in the bucket. The real problem, though, in my opinion, is that the fundamental rules of employment in the United States have changed over the last 30 years. I mean, this is the question that everybody asks. Why is it that 30 years ago, well, take it back a little farther than that, you know, roughly 35 years ago, almost 40 years ago, I was working in northern Michigan. I spent a summer, I spent some time out there picking apples. Now, and I wasn't surrounded by immigrants from Mexico. I was surrounded by people from Michigan who were picking apples, by and large. Now, why was that? And it wasn't, you know, it wasn't really high-paid work, but it was summer work for a teenager. I mean, there were a lot of teenagers, but there were adults out there as well. Why is it that just in the last 30 years, all of a sudden, there has been this explosion in immigrant labor in the United States? And, of course, there are the racists among us who want to point to the immigrants and say, oh, they're the problem. And then there are, you know, the folks who say, oh, well, you know, it's just the employers. If the employers were able to, you know, the law says you can't hire an illegal immigrant. And so and the employers are simply saying, well, you know, we didn't know he's really illegal, because anybody can get papers to show that they have a green card or that they're a legal immigrant. You know, for $50, $100, you can buy the papers. There's no shortage of counterfeiters doing this kind of stuff. So, you know, so therefore they say we need to have a national identity card, yet they have this Real ID Act. Well, my take on this is that it's got nothing to do with identity and enforcing the laws, or very little, and it has very little to do with Mexicans in general coming into the United States or other immigrants from other countries. There's other, certainly Central and Latin and South American countries, Latin American countries, that are coming into this country illegally. That instead what it has to do with is the fundamental change in the way that we deal with labor in the United States ever since Ronald Reagan became president. Ever since Reagan declared war on organized labor, on democracy in the workplace, on the unions, ever since Reagan declared war on organized labor and thus war on the American middle class, we have seen the steady degrading of workplace opportunities for the middle class. You've seen the steady erosion of the middle class in the United States. We are the only nation in the world, fully industrialized nation in the world, that doesn't provide health care for all of its citizens as a right of citizenship. And so you have this catch. And the third part, there's actually four pieces to this equation. The third part of the equation is that there hasn't been an increase in the minimum wage in almost forever, in a decade or more or less. And so it's at $5.15. Nobody can live at that. And then on top of that, you have the fact that we've had a trade policy now, largely since Bill Clinton. This is not a Republican or Democratic issue, I can tell you that. This is a sin of Bill Clinton as much as it is the cons who have been pushing this thing ever since Reagan, of signing WTO and NAFTA and GATT, and now CAFTA is on the table. These conservative Republicans and conservative Democrats pushing for what they call free trade. There's nothing free about it. The WTO agreement has so many pages in it, it would fill this studio if you put all the pages in here. And when you pull all these things together, the fact that employers pay for health care in the United States, and so increasingly employers are looking for employees who don't demand health care, well, that's illegal, so they can't demand anything. They're illegal, number one. Number two, you've got an obscenely low minimum wage, so employers feel free to pay very little. And that will drive, and truth be told, $6 an hour is not a lot to people living in America. It's a lot to somebody living in Mexico. In fact, according to Lou Dobbs, almost 10% of the entire Mexican economy is money being sent back to Mexico from people who live and work in the United States illegally. One of the reasons why Vicente Fox is producing a pamphlet that says, here's how to get into the United States without getting caught. And number three, our trade laws, our trade policies have, you know, these conservative trade policies have worked to wipe out the manufacturing base in the United States. So the middle class jobs are fleeing. So all that's left are these low paying jobs that are being. And because we have such a low minimum wage, an obscenely low minimum wage, an absurdly low minimum wage, and because the big employers in those industries, and McDonald's and Walmart and Burger King and, you know, right across the board, all the cheap labor industries have been successful in fighting unionization. By and large, you combine all those things, and there you have the perfect storm that leads to a situation where an American who is, like Sean called in yesterday to this program, and he said that he was on disability and he would love to work, but if he went to work, you know, if it was at a minimum wage job or a $6 or $7 or $8 an hour job, if he went to work, he would lose the health care that he's entitled to as a person on disability, and the health care, he wouldn't be able to afford it if he was working at those kinds of wages. And so we have this system that the cons have totally screwed up so badly that Americans can't afford to work for $7 or $8 an hour. So the cons can say, oh, Americans won't do those jobs. Nonsense. Americans will work in sewers. Americans will clean toilets. Americans have a long history of doing all kinds of jobs, any kind of job imaginable, if they're paid well. It's very simple. You remember Ralph Cramden? Was it Ralph Cramden? No, it was what was the character's name that was played by Art Carney on the old Honeymooners program with Ralph Cramden was Jackie Gleason's character and his friend, Ralph's friend, who worked in the sewers of New York. And they made jokes about him coming home smelling like the sewers. He was earning a union wage. It was good, honest work. So here, as a result of conservative economic policies, in my opinion, we have this crisis of immigration. And the answer is not to seal the border. The answer is not to attack the immigrants. The answer is not to have a national ID card. The answer is to change our labor and trade policies and our health care policies in the United States so that once again a middle class can flourish in this country, because it's being ripped apart, shredded, and thrown away by the conservatives. 1-866-889-8894, telephone number. Mike in D.C. on the line. Hey, Mike, what are your thoughts on all this? Oh, hang on just a second. Let me push the right button here. Hey, Mike.
Oh, there you are.
Yep. Sorry about that.
Okay. A couple of quickies on the foreign labor issue. One thing that keeps on getting left out of the equation, I believe, is the fact that one of the reasons why so many people are coming here is because of our policies, our foreign policies, that we have shoved down people's throats. We have ruined the economies of many of these countries. I mean, literally.
Mexico joined NAFTA, and it created more poverty for Mexico.
Exactly. Well, not only that, but we go around the world demanding that, okay, you've got to do these the shock therapy. You've got to privatize
right. Everything
you own.
Yeah, the IMF stuff. Yeah, the religion of the free market.
Correct.
And it's a cult.
And once we do that, they can't survive even in their own country because there are no jobs left. There's no money left.
Right. Yeah, I don't disagree with that, although I would say that it's not, it sounds very cold to say that's not my problem, but that's a reality. We have to deal in America with America's problems first.
Well, yeah, but one of our problems is we have to stop these insane policies.
Right,
we're
exporting the insanity.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And you know, one of the reasons why all these immigrants managed to survive at minimum wage and below, well, good grief, if you look at it, you will see, let's say, Vietnamese or Chinese or Mexican. They pile so many people into one apartment. They're all working, usually as a family, an extended family. They're all working at some job somewhere. And so when they combine all that together, they can actually survive.
Right.
You know. And you're right.
But a lot of those are actually legal immigrants, particularly
right.
The Asian immigrants. They're legal immigrants. I'm concerned about the illegal immigration. And because, you know, we've always been a nation of legal immigrants, and we've always encouraged, actually, immigration at a certain level. But the illegal immigration is a real problem in this nation, and I'm concerned that it's being demagogued on the right, on the left, and in the middle. Everybody is demagoguing it because everybody is either pointing to the immigrants or pointing to the employers or pointing to the American workers and saying, oh, it's the immigrants' fault for coming here illegally, or it's the employers' fault for hiring them illegally, or it's the American workers' fault for not wanting to take those jobs. And it's none of their faults. It's the fault of these insane economic policies. And that's the bottom line for me. Michael, thanks a lot for the call. I got to move along. 10 minutes before the hour.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
I said, hold it, Doc. The World War passed through my brain. He said, nurse, get your pad. The boy's obviously insane. He grabbed my arm and I said, ouch, as I landed on the psychiatric couch. He said, tell me about it, your dream.
Yeah, tell me about it. 5 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-889-8894. Our telephone number, Scott in Humboldt County on the line. Hey, Scott.
Oop. How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
Real good. Listen, just real quick, I was just talking to Senator Feinstein's office about the National ID.
Yeah, the Real ID Act. It's been amended to the legislation to fund Iraq.
Yeah, that's what drives me crazy is we can install Gestapo tactics on the Iraq supplement bill, but we can't add on some money for veterans who are coming home and need help with PTSD, you know?
Yeah, or who need help with physical problems as well. I mean, they're slashing veterans benefits in real dollars. Yeah, well, that's the official official Republican line is say one thing and do another. I mean, that's
yep.
So.
Absolutely. Well, thanks a lot, man. Just wanted to throw that out there. Let everybody know to call their Congress people and let them know their senators that they're absolutely opposed to it, and we need to at least make a stink about how they're trying to just shove this in there.
That's right. Stop the Real ID Act. 1-877-SOB-USOB is the toll-free number for the United States Senate and the House of Representatives. Call your member of Congress. Well said, Scott. Thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. 1-866-889-8894. Armin in Florida on the line. Hey, Armin.
I want your opinion of something.
Okay.
Would you be for Bush's guest worker program if it replaced the public union workers in this country for 10 cents on the dollar and save the taxpayers money?
No.
And then
I mean, that's what it's all about, and that's why I say no. We both know, Armin, that the guest worker program is all about more cheap labor for corporations.
Yeah, but I mean, would you be for it if it replaced the public unions? If they start getting stuck, maybe they'll start squealing.
They're already squealing. The public unions are already very, very worried. It's just that they can't speak out because they work for the government. They can't engage in political activity.
See, if this went down, if he got his guest worker program in, what he really wants to do, and then incorporated it, and then they could get the Wall Street criminals behind it, and then they could buy up these blocks of money that's spent in taxpayer money for different municipalities and different services and bring the workers in and stick the money in their pocket, and then it'd be a self-fulfilling prophecy because they wouldn't want to do those jobs any longer because it wouldn't pay anything.
Yeah. And then you're left with the rich few and the serfs. Everybody else is a serf. Everybody else becomes, you know, property. That's the conservative vision for America. Armin, thanks for the call. You say it well. I appreciate it, my friend. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. 57 million in federal aid cut to adult education programs just in the state of Washington. What's happening around the country with that? We'll get into that. And I may have a little audio surprise for you after the break. Tom Hartman with you at the top of the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Covers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, the third hour of our program. Our telephone number, 1-866-889-8894. TomHartman.com if you'd like to drop in for live chat. Louis Grizzard was an amazing comedian. He is now deceased. He lived down in Georgia. Back in the years when I lived in Georgia, when I used to live down in Atlanta, this was well over a decade ago, and I remember one time hearing him tell a joke, and I have to share this with you as setup for an audio clip that I'm going to share with you in just a minute. He told this incredible joke. It was about a revival tent meeting. This preacher had come to town in this small southern Georgia town, and he'd come to town, and he'd set up the revival tent, and he had everybody out there Wednesday night, and he was doing his thing, and he was out there going, "Tell it all, brother, tell it all. You got to confess your sin." And he's just going through this whole rap, and this one guy jumps up and goes, "Preacher, I've been drinking away all my money. I've been drinking away all the family's money. I just tell you, our family's broke." And the preacher says, "Tell it all, brother, tell it all." And another guy jumps up and he says, "Preacher, I've been running around with wild women." And he says, "Tell it all, brother, tell it all." Another guy jumps up and he says, I've been gambling away my family's money." And preacher says, "Tell it all, brother, tell it all." And another guy jumps up and he says, "Preacher, last week I had sex with a goat." And there's this long pause, and the preacher says, "Damn, brother, I'm not sure I would have told that." Now, I tell you this joke by way of setup for this clip. This is from the Alan Colmes radio show. Alan Colmes of Hannity and Colmes fame. And he's interviewing Neil Horsley. Neil Horsley is the conservative who runs the website that lists abortion doctors and shows you where you can find abortion doctors. And so far, one of the doctors on his list has actually been murdered. Several of them have been stalked. Many of them have been put out of business. All of them are terrified. This is the guy who runs the website that points to how to find abortion doctors that you two can kill. And last night on Alan Colmes' radio program, Alan was interviewing him, and the subject came up of a comment that was made in Esquire magazine. Just listen along, my friends.
By the way, it also points out that in Esquire magazine interview, you acknowledged taking part in homosexual sex and bestiality in the 70s.
That's my point, Alan. I mean, just
is that
because,
true?
Because it's printed in the news media or on the internet, everybody is jumps to believe
must
it.
Must be a liberal
reality,
conspiracy.
If I say the truth,
is that true?
People say that's not. Hey, Alan, if you want to accuse me of having sex when I was a fool, I did everything that crossed my mind that looked feel good.
You had sex with animals?
As an active hedonist. Absolutely. I was a fool.
You had sex with animals?
Oh, when you grow up on a farm in Georgia, and your first girlfriend is a mule.
I'm not so sure that's so.
That's because you didn't grow up on a farm in Georgia.
Alan is a little flabbergasted here, as you can imagine.
Did you?
Are you suggesting that everybody who grows up on a farm in Georgia has a mule as a girlfriend?
And now he goes on to tell Alan that because he's a liberal, you people don't know.
It has historically been the case. You people are so far removed from the
reality.
Look,
I'll admit, Neil, I'm a city boy. I don't know a lot about growing up on a farm.
Hello, welcome to domestic life on the farm.
But I think for you to say, there are a lot of people listening to you, Neil. There are a lot of people listening to me right now who live on farms, are raising kids on farms, who grew up on farms, and I don't think they're dating Elsie right now. You know what I'm saying?
The fact of the matter is, don't know that in fact you experiment with anything that moves when you're growing up sexually, you're naive and you know better than that. You know yourself.
And it gets weirder from there. So I'll just stop it right now. But anyhow, of all the strange things, if I had the theme music for Green Acres, actually maybe I do. Yeah, I do. Eureka! Here's our theme music. It's for this particular little ditty here. How come it's not playing? I don't know. Come on here, you.
Yes.
There we go. The official theme music of the anti-abortion movement in the United States now, the right-wingers who are out to kill abortion doctors. This, their new theme music. Yes, indeed. Head out to Green Acres and all your problems are solved.
Green Acres is the place to be.
Oh, yes.
Farm living is the life for me.
Yes, indeed.
Land spreading out so far and wide. Keep Manhattan, just give me that countryside.
Yes, as Neil Horsley would say. So, your entertainment for the day. We'll just leave it at that. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number, if you'd like to call in. This is probably not the issue to weigh in on. I do think that the issue of immigration, illegal immigration, deserves some more discussion. But, you know, whatever you want to talk about is just fine. In fact, Billy in Santa Cruz is on the line. Hey, Billy, how you doing?
Hi, Tom. Hope you're well.
I am, and I hope you are, too.
Thank you. I wanted to make a joke about that joke you just told, and then I have a comment.
Okay.
And why should we be surprised if somebody finds a jackass attractive that they find George Bush attractive?
Yeah, there you go.
Okay.
Speaking of jackasses, yes.
Yeah, you know. Speaking of jackasses, Billy's on the phone. I was just looking at some blog stuff, and I hit on the words, lies about Iraq or whatever. And it took me back to an article. This is so funny. The article was on Christmas Day, interestingly enough, in 2003. That's the day when Tenet came out and said, oh, yeah, you know, Bush had every reason to believe in that uranium claim. You know, the one from
Right. Yeah. The one that Joe Wilson discredited.
Yeah. And, At the time, as soon as he said it, I knew he was lying. And I'm going to read you the 16 words that he said.
Okay.
You tell me where the obvious lie is. Quote, the British government has learned that Saddam Hussein recently sought significant quantities of uranium from Africa. How did I know that was a lie?
Well, I'm assuming because you're an intelligent, well-read person, Billy.
Well, but remember, this is before we knew anything about it.
And also, he's attributing it to a third party.
There you go. Let me tell you something about intelligence. You don't say where you got it.
Yeah, unless you're covering your butt.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, you know, first of all, I think that for the more intelligent among us, we knew that second, because I know how people speak and I know how we speak about intelligence. And then, you know, I love the fact that they did it on Christmas Day when they admitted that they, you know, had misled the president.
Yeah. Well, it's not a big news day. So there you go.
That was the point.
Yep. Yep. Billy, thanks a lot for the call.
Thanks.
Good to hear from you. That's definitely the point. So our bizarre sex habits of the extreme right wing alert for the day is done. And hopefully we won't revisit that. But speaking of Fox News, also known as Faux News, perhaps you didn't catch this. We talked about it yesterday on this program. But it is, you know, it is being picked up by the press in small ways here and there. The number three man in Al-Qaeda who was captured last week, who George W. went on TV, George Jr. went on TV and said, oh, we got the number three guy in Al-Qaeda. We're
tough. No girly men here.
George W. going on and saying that, and then Condi Rice coming on and saying, yes, he's a very senior guy and all this kind of stuff. Well, three different Fox News reports, of course, were gushing about him. This is from newshounds.us, the folks whose slogan is, we watch Fox so you don't have to. And I know, I'm serious. Well, they've been on this program, so you probably know. Anyhow, the allegations of mistaken identity and the capture of reported number three man in Al-Qaeda. Allegations of mistaken identity? Say what? Well, it turns out they were claiming, the administration has been claiming, that they caught or that we caught, that the Pakistanis caught with our help, the number three guy in Al-Qaeda. Bush was taking credit for it. Rice was taking credit for it. It was great. It blew all over the, it blew every story off the news pages. It was a day that 50 people had died in Iraq. Didn't matter. U.S. GIs died. Didn't matter. None of that got reported because we got the number three guy in Al-Qaeda. Yes, indeed, Americans, you are safe. You need not worry any longer. The number three guy in Al-Qaeda is under control. We've got him. Except it turns out we don't have him. Turns out that the guy that we caught is a guy named Al Libby, L-I-B-B-I, and the guy who's the number three guy in Al-Qaeda that we wanted is a guy named Al Libby, spelled A-L-L-I-B-Y. He's a different guy from a different country, a different part of the world. And this guy, this Al Libby that we caught, he was an intern in the Al-Qaeda office in London. Yes, he made photocopies and coffee. That's what he did. Yes, Al-Qaeda had an office back before they were officially banned. And then the spokesman for the administration comes forward. The administration, they say, well, why wasn't this guy, this was before it was known, this was before it was revealed that it was a case of mistaken identity, and it was one of our allies that pointed this out to us, presumably Britain. But before it was revealed that it was a case of mistaken identity, although we should have known, anyhow, one of the reporters came to an official of the administration, the Bush administration, and said, how is it that this guy is not on our most wanted list? I mean, this guy, L-I-B-B-I, why is he not on the most wanted list? And whoever the unnamed senior State Department official was who responded, he said, well, we didn't want him to know that we were looking for him. Yeah. A little fast dancing. Anyhow, so back to faux news. So the story's out now that the original story was a phony. It was a phony. It didn't actually happen. We didn't catch the number three guy in Al-Qaeda. We caught an intern, like the number 490th guy, or maybe the 490,000th guy. But that didn't stop Fox News gushing about it. On Saturday night's Fox Report, anchor Paige Hopkins gushed that a notebook belonging to Al Libby had been seized, her emphasis, seized. Reporter Steve Sansani said that the fact that Al Libby tried to destroy the notebook is another indicator of how valuable it might be. Steve Pomerantz, former assistant FBI director, confirmed this with the convoluted logic that Al Libby had not expected to be picked up. He said, therefore, you had to assume that he didn't expect his notebook, which he believed to be secure, to fall into our hands. It's very logical to conclude, certainly to assume, that there is significant intelligence to be gleaned from that notebook. Yes, his girlfriend's phone number. Well, the story is out now. I mean, keep in mind, in the Times, Bush called Al Libby a top general. Condi Rice, a very important figure. The guy that we're actually looking for, Anas Al Libby, L-I-B-Y, not L-I-B-B-I, wanted over the 1998 East African embassy bombings. He's not the number three guy in Al-Qaeda anyway, but nonetheless, he's actually on our most wanted list, but he's not the guy that got caught, even though they decided to tell us that. Well, the Sunday Times, the Times of London on Sunday published this. Big deal. Big story. Number three claims a lie. I mean, that wasn't the exact headline, but it was to that effect that, you know, oops, or somebody lied, or something's going on. So can you find evidence of this anywhere on the Fox News website? No. Any evidence that Fox News has, in the same screaming way that they pointed out that the number three guy was caught, now pointed out that, well, he wasn't really the number three guy. In fact, he wasn't even any guy. Just some guy with a similar name. And the Three Stooges administration once again screws up intelligence, just like we so badly screwed up intelligence between January and September of 2001 that it led to 9/11. And Condi Rice, who supervised that, now is in the Secretary of State. 20 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Watch out for me, woman. and don't mind nobody else.
Unless you're a donkey.
Watch out for me, woman, and don't mind nobody else.
And the guy who's got an eye on you is one of these anti-abortion doctor killers.
Crystal ball, but the future ain't hard to tell.
And welcome back, my friends. A few simple statistics for your edification. The percent of judicial nominees confirmed by president. 93.1% of Jimmy Carter's nominees were confirmed. 96% of Ronald Reagan's nominees were confirmed. 96% of Bush Jr.'s nominees were confirmed. The low numbers belong to Bush 1 and Clinton. Bush 1, the Bush Sr., 78%, and Clinton, 87.9%, 88%. But the other three presidents, Carter, Reagan, and Bush Jr., all three of them in the 90s, Carter at 93% of his judicial nominees confirmed, Reagan at 96.1%, and Bush at 96.6%, the highest of all five last presidents. And now you know, as Paul Harvey would say, the rest of the story. In fact, the Democrats are starting to fight back. They're starting, you know, with a truth war. A truth war. How dare they? Tell the truth? Let's just go through the voting records of a few Republican senators. Robert Bennett, in alphabetical order, no less. Robert Bennett of Utah. He voted to filibuster 13 Clinton executive nominees. Walter Dellinger, Janet Napolitano, Sam W. Brown, Derek Scherr, Ricky Tiegert, Henry Foster, and five State Department nominees. Christopher Bond of Missouri, Republican Senator Christopher Bond, voted to filibuster 9 Clinton executive nominees. Sam Brownback of Kansas voted to filibuster 3 Clinton nominees, 2 for judicial appointments. Jim Bunning of Kentucky, Republican Senator Jim Bunning of Kentucky, voted to filibuster 2 Clinton judicial nominees, Marsha Berzon and Richard Paez. Republican Senator Conrad Burns of Montana voted to filibuster 10 Clinton executive nominees, voted to indefinitely postpone a vote on Richard Paez's nomination. Senator Thad Cochran, the Republican from Mississippi, voted to filibuster 11 of Clinton's executive nominees. Are you noticing a trend here? Senator Larry Craig, Republican from Idaho, voted to filibuster 13 Clinton nominees, both executive and judicial. 2 of those votes were for filibusters for judicial nominees, Berzon and Paez. The Republican senator from Idaho, Michael Crapo, he's got to pronounce it differently than that, C-R-A-P-O, however he says it, voted to indefinitely postpone a vote on Richard Paez's nomination. It's got to be Crapo, right? Nobody would call themselves. Anyhow, Mike DeWine, the Republican representative from Ohio, voted to filibuster 3 Clinton nominees, both executive and judicial. 2 of the filibuster votes were for judicial nominees, Berzon and Paez, to the Ninth Circuit on 3800. Voted to block 2 nominees. Republican Senator from New Mexico, Pete Domenici, voted to filibuster 10 Clinton executive nominees, voted to filibuster the nomination of Stephen G. Breyer to the appellate court in 1980, voted to filibuster the nominations of William Lubbers and Don Allen Zimmerman to the NLRB in 1980. No, Republicans never vote to filibuster nominees. Never happens. Michael Enzi of Washington voted to filibuster 3 Clinton nominees, judicial and executive. Bill Frist voted to filibuster 1 Clinton nominee, a judicial nominee, a judge, for Judge Richard Paez, filibustered by Bill Frist. Chuck Grassley, the Republican senator from Iowa, voted to filibuster 11 Clinton nominees. The list goes on and on. Judd Gregg, Republican from New Hampshire, voted to filibuster 11 Clinton executive nominees. Orrin Hatch of Utah blocked the nomination of Clinton nominee Helen White to the Sixth Circuit Court in Michigan. Blocked the nomination of Clinton nominee J. Richard Leonard to the Fourth Circuit in North Carolina. And on it goes, voted to filibuster 11 Clinton nominees. Yes, the Republicans.
bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
You're gonna break another heart. You're gonna tell another lie.
And welcome back, my friends. 27 minutes before the hour. I guess that's the theme song for the Limbaugh show. We're not going to do that here. We're going to tell you what's really going on in America here. Andy Borowitz, for example, BorowitzReport.com. This special report, Secretary of Defense Don Rumsfeld, writes Andy Borowitz, told reporters at the Pentagon today that the conflict in Iraq had improved to the point. Now, this is a news flash here, friends. Had improved to the point that it could no longer be considered a quagmire and instead should now be considered or thought of as a morass. Rumsfeld said, after taking a look at what is going on the ground, it is my judgment that it's time to upgrade Iraq from quagmire to morass. Rumsfeld added that he was very confident in making the new assessment. The defense secretary said that the decision to invade Iraq could no longer be considered, quote, a boneheaded mistake of unthinkable proportions, end quote, and should instead now be thought of as simply a colossal error we will regret for years to come. He said there's a measure of how much things, that's a measure of how much things have improved. Anyone who takes a look at the big picture over there would come away saying that the situation is disastrous, but not catastrophic. Rumsfeld appeared to bristle at the question of one reporter, Charles Dolgian of the Toledo Blade, who asked if it was still appropriate to refer to the war in Iraq as a train wreck. It is most decidedly not a train wreck, Mr. Rumsfeld said. It is a train derailment, in which the train hurtles down the embankment and bursts into flames. That from Andy Borowitz, theborowitzreport.com. Thank you, Andy, for that. Always good to know what's really going on, right? Oil prices through the roof. Absolutely through the roof. Exit polls. Oh, my. The Texas legislature, maybe you saw this in the Ironic Times, Texas legislature ponders ban on sexually suggestive cheerleading in high school. The piece of legislation would also rename the Dallas Cowboy Cheerleaders as the Dallas Christian Ladies Prayer and Temperance Circle. Most judges following controversy over judges closely. The majority are supporting Paula Abdul. And a man comatose for 10 years suddenly awakens. What happened to the surplus, he asks an astonished nurse. Well, you see, it's all about the money. It's all about the money. That's, you want to know the conservative agenda? It's all about the money. 'Tis the season again, notes the progress report of sky-high gas prices. And according to the Department of Energy, they're here to stay, with costs likely to average around $2.25 throughout the summer. I just had my monthly fill-up, by the way. Not to brag, but once a month, more or less. Sometimes less. Once a month, though, on average, I have to fill up my car. Because I'm driving a Toyota Prius. It's a 3-year-old Prius, but maybe it's a 4-year-old Prius. I don't know. I've had it for a couple of years. Anyway, it runs great. And doesn't use much gas. It averages around 45 miles to the gallon, so it's kind of nice. Anyhow, this means the added burden on America's middle class is growing, the cost of gasoline. Of course, Greenspan doesn't consider this inflation. No, that's not inflation. Inflation is when people's wages go up. We can't have that. Can't allow that. Diesel Creek says stop bragging in the chat room. You can drop by our chat room, by the way, if you want. Go to TomHartman.com and click live chat. It'll get you in there. Anyhow, high gas prices hit Americans in other unexpected ways, notes the progress report. And this is a good one, well said. Pressuring local businesses to increase costs, curtailing vacation and travel plans, which would otherwise, of course, inject money into the economy. Even jacking up prices for the flowers you sent to mom last weekend. Hey, she's worth it, right? But the delivery costs more. So you get fewer flowers for the same price, or you pay more for the same number of flowers. So what is the conservative response to this? Well, the cons have a plan. They have a plan. Oh, we got a plan. Don't you worry, the cons say. What's the plan? Well, let's increase demand for oil and raise gas prices some more. Yes, that's the con plan. President Bush has admitted his energy bill will not change the price at the pump today, but that's just half the story. A 2004 analysis by the administration's own Energy Information Administration. This is an agency within the Bush administration. Last year did an analysis of Bush's energy program and discovered that the Bush-backed energy bill will actually raise gas prices and increase oil demand nearly 14% by 2010. And that's even after profit-flushed oil and gas companies are flooded with subsidies. Now, this is really quite a feat when you think about it. Because if you think about free market economics, so-called free market economics, or let's just call it market economics. Think about market economics. It would, you know, logic would tend to imply or suggest that if you raise the price of something, that the demand for it will go down, right? You raise the price, demand goes down. The problem is that that's true of things that aren't essential to a person's life or lifestyle. But no matter how high the price of food goes, people are always going to be hungry. No matter how high the price of water goes, people are always going to want water. They're always going to need it to survive. No matter how high the price of electricity goes, people will pay it. Look at California. Went from $15 a megawatt hour to $1,000 a megawatt hour. People still paid it. Old Arnold Schwarzenegger colluding with Kenny Boy Lay. If you haven't seen the movie Enron, the smartest man and the smartest guys in the room, go see it. It's startling. Startling. I saw it last weekend. About the crimes of Enron and who got away with what and how. It's really grim. It really is. It's not grim like, you know, you go to the movie theater and you walk away depressed. It's sort of like, you know, you go to the theater and you walk away enlightened and angry. And it's got the whole thing about the Bush family connections and Arnold Schwarzenegger meeting with Kenny Lay in the Peninsula Hotel in Los Angeles in Beverly Hills during the energy crisis to help plan the strategy to overthrow Gray Davis and install Arnold Schwarzenegger as the oil industry's governor. Go see the movie. So anyhow, here at the same time, the administration is defying the laws of economic physics by raising the demand for gasoline and also raising the price of it. How do you do that? Well, you have a monopoly and you make sure that it's something that's essential. So they're not doing anything to decrease the essentialness of gasoline. They're not doing anything like suggesting that CAFE standards, the corporate average fleet efficiency standards, fuel efficiency standards for the fleets should be raised. This is the average gas mileage that all the cars manufactured by a particular manufacturer have to meet. They're not doing anything like offering, you know, they have actually offered a tax deduction if you buy a hybrid car, but it could be a lot more. I mean, you can get a $100,000 tax deduction if you buy a Hummer if you have a small business. But you can only get a $2,000 tax deduction if you buy a Prius or a Honda Insight. And what are the big three? What is GM? What are GM and Ford doing? They're still making big cars. You would think that they've been through this before in the 70s. You'd think that they would have figured it out. That some genius there at one of these companies would have said, "Hey, gasoline prices are going through the roof. You got an oil industry CEO as president. You got an oil industry CEO as vice president. Our Secretary of State has an oil tanker named after her. The president now of Afghanistan is the former consultant from Unocal who is trying to build a pipeline across that country, which they're now building, by the way." Taliban had said no. Remember the famous, the Bushies went over and said, "We'll give you a carpet of bombs or a carpet of gold." The Taliban took the bombs. Now Hamid Karzai is taking the gold. Pretty straightforward. Making a whole lot more than he was making as a consultant to Unocal, I can tell you that. Unocal, of course, now being bought by Chevron. Once Chevron Texaco. changing their name. Anyhow, back to this. So the oil companies have come to, you know, they came to the table with Dick Cheney in these energy meetings that we're never going to know about because the appeals court today ruled that the Bush administration doesn't have to tell us what happened when our employee Dick Cheney was having a private meeting with the oil industry officials. And they said, hey, we'd like some welfare money, please, Mr. Cheney. And he's like, well, let's see. Am I still getting payments from Halliburton? Why, indeed I am. And do I still own stock? Why, indeed I do. Well, I guess the oil industry better do better. And they got their money. $10 billion now scaled back to $8 billion. Originally it was like over $20 billion. Scaled back to $8 billion in direct welfare subsidies to the oil and gas and nuclear and coal industries in the Bush administration energy bill. Add $2 billion of that. This is really amazing. $2 billion. That's $1 million 1,000 times two. $2 billion was taken out of conservation funding. Out of conservation funding and put into the Ultra Deep Water Fund to pay for research on how to drill in very deep areas of the ocean, research that the oil companies are already doing and already funding all by themselves. This, you know, on top of $3.275 billion in new tax breaks to the oil and gas industry alone, this has produced a problem for the oil industry. The oil industry is now facing a significant problem. It's important that you know about this. People think that the reason why the price of gasoline has gone up is because the price of oil has gone up. Sorry, not the case. Price of gasoline in some part has gone up because the price of oil has gone up. But most of the price in gasoline going up, I mean, consider a barrel of oil, 55 gallons of oil, selling for, let's say, $50. And it will yield, say, 30, 35, 40 gallons of gasoline that are worth, that cost, a buck a gallon to produce. Back when it was $20 a barrel, it was, you know, a little cheaper than that. But anyhow, the bottom line is that the price of oil has gone up, but the price of gasoline has gone up a lot faster and a lot farther. It's basically pretty much doubled. The price of oil doubled too, but it's a different thing. You're talking a $50 raw material becoming $100. Well, you get the point. Anyhow, so the net effect of all of this is that the oil companies are awash in profits. They have more money floating around than they have ever seen in their existence. The oil companies, it just finished a quarter where they showed a greater profit than any oil company in the history of the oil industry. Ever before in history. The Wall Street Journal reported that ExxonMobil and Royal Dutch Shell Group, quoting from the Wall Street Journal, both reported huge increases in first quarter income, benefiting from the industry-wide bonanza, also swelling the coffer of their peers. High prices for the oil they pump and high margins for refining it. Oh, but the cons say, the reason for that is supply and demand. There's more demand for gasoline, and we haven't built a new refinery in 29 years. Or whatever the number is. Well, in fact, we have... If you consider building a refinery next door to a refinery and calling it an extension of that refinery, I suppose that's true. But the reality is that our refinery capacity has massively increased over the last three decades because we've made our refineries much, much larger. The simple reality is that most of the refineries are located where they are because that's where the crude oil comes into those parts of the country. And so they refine it to gasoline, put it in trucks, and ship it out. And so, by and large, you know, you've got all these refineries along the Gulf Coast and in Texas and Louisiana and Alabama, and you've got refineries along the East Coast, and you've got refineries along the West Coast where the oil tankers come in. Now, there's no shortage of gasoline. If there was a shortage of gasoline, you wouldn't be able to buy gasoline someplace. It's not about refinery capacity. And see, that excuse, number one, it's an excuse, and number two, it's a rationale for more welfare for the oil industry. They don't need more welfare. Now, what it is that these guys are making, they're price gouging us. It's a monopoly. They control the industry. They control all the supply of oil. And they're willing to bring down our economy. They're willing to drag down our economy to profit themselves. Exxon's soon-to-retire CEO suddenly has a new anxiety, says the Wall Street Journal, how to spend the windfall wrought by $55 barrel oil, or alternatively by $2.25 a gallon gasoline, Fortune magazine reports. If oil simply stays where it is now, Exxon's cash could approach $40 billion in 12 months. By then, Exxon's CEO is expected to hand off the top job and the headache of what to do with all that cash. Well, one thing that they're doing with it is they're paying themselves. The average direct compensation. Now, keep in mind, if you pay a CEO anything over $1 million, it's not tax deductible as an expense to the corporation. This is a law that was passed some years ago to try and discourage, excessive compensation of CEOs. The average CEO compensation, $16.5 million. Now, that's the actual cash. And in addition to that, they make zillions in stock options and all kinds of other things. The increase from 2003 to 2004, this is the consequence of the Bush oil policies, 109.1%. More than doubled. Average pay for oil industry CEOs more than doubled in 1 year. By far the highest of all the industries profiled, according to Fortune magazine. More than doubled. When you buy gas at the pump, you are putting cash into the pockets of the big oil companies who are the sponsors of the Bush administration. They were the sponsors of the Reagan administration. It's the Bush oil family, as they say. 10 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman with you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back, my friends. Time for a John Bolton alert. Yes, believe it or not, they still keep on coming. All those hits. The Senate looking into this, nomination of John Bolton to be our United Nations ambassador by the Bush administration. And Richard Armitage, he's the former Deputy Secretary of State, the number two guy under Colin Powell. You'll recall, Colin Powell has refused to endorse Bolton. He just won't do it. He won't condemn him, but he won't endorse him. And so his number two guy, Richard Armitage, he's a team player. And the Bushies got to him and they said, hey, come on, you got to play along. And so Armitage comes out and he gives Bolton this great endorsement. He says, oh, he's a great guy. He's wonderful. You go blah, 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 do whatever, And it kind of took Larry Wilkerson by surprise. Larry Wilkerson was the chief of staff to Colin Powell. And so he worked with Armitage and Powell and Bolton. And according to testimony by Wilkerson, Armitage had, quote, now this is quoting from Wilkerson, the guy who worked with them, the chief of staff to Colin Powell. Armitage had, quote, frequent battles with Bolton over his diplomatic tone until ultimately blocking Bolton from delivering speeches and testimony unless they were personally approved by Mr. Armitage. So here you got Richard Armitage, the Deputy Secretary of State, saying to Bolton, you're not allowed to speak anymore unless I read it first. He was that worried about Bolton being an absolute loose cannon, over the top, over the edge, done, gone, cooked, nuts. It was 2 years ago that he laid these rules down, and he laid them down not on everybody in the State Department, not on everybody at senior levels in the State Department, not on anybody who had an opportunity to speak to the public, but only on John Bolton. And over time, did he ease up? No, he got more rigid in holding this restriction. If anything, they got more stringent as time went on. In another interview, the former director of the National Intelligence Council described Bolton as an individual who took isolated facts and made much more of them to build a case than Hutchins thought the intelligence warranted. It was a sort of cherry-picking of little factoids and little isolated bits that were drawn out to present the starkest possible case. Yes, we saw that in Iraq. I'm not sure we want to see it again in a UN ambassador. I'm Tom Hartman. Thanks for being with us today. We'll see you tomorrow. Same time, same place.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.